You are listening to Down Home. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, founded in 1966, is a group often vilified but profoundly misunderstood. Emerging during the turbulent era of the Civil Rights Movement, the Panthers played a pivotal role in challenging systemic racism, police brutality, and inequality in America. In this episode, me and Jay will talk about the truth behind the Black Panthers, a group whose legacy extends far beyond the headlines. We'll explore how they were more than just a militant organization, but a beacon of empowerment and resistance for Black communities across the United States and Canada. It's crucial to understand that many of the conditions that birthed the Black Panthers still plague communities of color today. From police violence to economic inequality, the struggles of the past are often echoed in the present. The Panthers also forged collaborative links to the Canadian Black Civil Rights Movement. Their impact resonated beyond the U.S. border, sparking a wave of solidarity among Black communities in Canada. I'm Derek Wise, and on behalf of Jay Jones, welcome to Down Home, the Canadian experience by two Black men. Breaking new ground, breaking new ground, breaking new ground, simple breaking new ground, breaking new ground, breaking new ground, simple breaking new ground, breaking new ground, breaking new ground, simple breaking new ground, breaking new ground, breaking new ground, yeah. On a high plateau, from the one down below to the future of the funk, getting lost in the flow, contact with the spot.
All right. So you came up with this really good idea of taking a closer look at the Black Panthers, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I don't know what you think, but a lot of their reasoning for coming about, like our community, our Black community faces today.
Yeah, it's an ongoing thing. Yeah, like, I mean, how they came about was basically, it was a little bit different. There was a migration into places like Oakland and San Fran after World War II with a lot of Blacks who went there to get jobs in the industry, mainly the shipyards and different things. They were places of industry. But the younger people faced a new thing that I think our older generation didn't face, because the older generation that raised us, or even our parents and our great grandparents, we knew what we were up. They knew what they were up against, but they kept their head down and they did what they had to do to raise the family, keep the family together. And because they already aware of what racial kind of things existed. But in the area of this particular time, you had people who were younger and were facing a little bit more of more racism, tons of poverty, and ghettos were really actually kind of being established. So therefore, you had everyone was in the crux of trying to do better, but the system was rigged, you know.
Yeah,
basically. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. So, and that was rife in the area that they actually started. So it was 1966 in Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was the an epicenter of poverty and systemic racism. Definitely, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like they wanted to put, you know, coming from the generation of keep your head down, these sort of young Blacks were a little bit more outspoken and wanted to stand up against the political regimes that wrote there with their own sort of political kind of agenda, or at least trying to face some of these issues that, you know. And it was a time. It was also the 60s. Mm. It was a huge time for Blacks in North America as a whole. You had leaders standing up going, what the hell is going on? You had the sort of dissipation of the Jim Crow laws. And so therefore, those things were changing, but the court of public opinion was different, right?
Mm.
Especially when it came to Blacks and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. this organization was a little bit different because they, unlike the overall civil rights movement, which was dominated by Dr. King, like he preached like the nonviolent path,
mm-hmm.
right? So what this organization, which was started by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale,
yeah,
is their edict or their methodology was sort of in line with Malcolm X, except for the crux on religion,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I did find in the research that they did have like a 10-point credo.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. Yeah, which
the Ten Commandments kind of vibe.
Yeah. The first point was we want freedom. They wanted power to determine the destiny of their community. The second point was we want full employment. They believed that the federal government was obligated and able to give everyone employment or a guaranteed income. This is similar to the concept that has been proposed here in Canada, the Netherlands, Namibia, and even certain states in the US. The third point was we want an end to the robbery by the capitalists. The premise under this point is that when slavery was ended back in the 1800s, 40 acres and a mule was promised as restitution for slavery. The Panthers wanted the economic equivalent of the 40 acres and a mule to be distributed among black communities. The fourth point was, we want decent housing. They wanted an end to the slums and the ghettos, and the creation of co-ops so the community could build decent housing. The fifth point was, we want education for our people. They wanted an education system that would give black people a knowledge of self. Number six is, we want all black men to be exempt from military service. They wanted black people not to be forced to fight in the military to defend what they believed to be a government that did not protect black citizens. Seven was, we want an immediate end to police brutality. The Black Panthers had more of a militant spin on how to bring this about. They wanted organized and armed black self-defense groups dedicated to defending black communities against police. We want freedom for all black men was the eighth point. This was freedom for all black men held in federal, state, and county prisons. This point is centered around the belief that black people found guilty did not receive a fair and impartial trial. To go along with point eight, point nine is we want all black people brought to trial to be tried by a jury of their peers. In other words, people from their communities, as defined by the Constitution of the United States. The 10th point was basically a summation of the previous 9 points. The 10th point was, we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace. So this was the 1960s, so I'm assuming by bread they meant money. The thing is, though, right, there's been this huge recently, and I think it has a lot to do with like the out of control increase in prices and cost of living. There's been a huge outcry about people, not just the black community, but people in general, saying these very things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that got me thinking, like, because essentially they started off as being this organization that was looking for protection of the black community.
Yeah.
But then once they started with this 10-point credo, they became like a Marxist socialist type organization.
Yeah.
And, you know, socialism is such a dirty word in North America, right? But
mm-hmm.
even though it's a dirty word, we have socialist leanings in all over Canadian society. Like our medical, our healthcare system is socialized.
Mm-hmm.
Our military is socialized, right? It's funded by the people, basically,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah. So like, but the thing is, though, it's got this weird, and it's because And I don't want to get into the like weird leanings of conspiracy theories, but socialism and it in the way that it operates is in direct opposition to capitalism and free markets, right?
Yeah.
So that's why it gets such a bad rap.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that Marxism and socialism is actually what people are thumping their fists about these days, right? Yeah, because, like, when you think about it, what Carl, like, one of the things that I did when I was in my second stint in university, I took a few credits in some political theory. And I did do a project on Karl Marx and some of his ideologies, right? And essentially, the crux of Marxism is that capitalism is a dying system. And he said this way back in the turn of the 19th century, and it's because the it's a system where the powers of production are held by a few.
Yeah.
And it's inherently unfair to the workers, the many. Karl Marx, the influential German philosopher and revolutionary socialist, laid the foundation for understanding socioeconomic systems and their inherent inequalities. Marxian economics, as described by Marx, highlights the inherent unfairness within the capitalist system, especially in the way they treat the majority of the population, the working people. Marx viewed the capitalist system of production as one where the laboring class, presenting the majority, faced exploitation and injustice. The few people that control the means of production, according to Marx, form the economic base of society. This economic base, in turn, shapes the entire societal structure, including its political and legal institutions. The people that hold economic power and dominance consequently hold sway over other aspects of the society. The Black Panthers, like Marx, recognized the systemic injustices that stemmed from the prevailing socioeconomic order. They fought against the entrenched dominance of the cultural, economic, and political majority. In other words, our white society that marginalized and oppressed Black people. I say our white society because it's the truth. Yes, I'm a Black man, but me, Jay, and every other person of Black ethnicity that lives in North America lives in a white society. Just as Marx highlighted the exploitation of the laboring class under capitalism, the Black Panthers sought to bring attention to the exploitation and oppression faced by Black communities. They aimed for the redistribution of economic power, calling for an end to the economic disparities that disproportionately affected Black individuals and communities. Moreover, Marx's idea that the economic base shaped the rest of society resonated with the Black Panthers' understanding of systemic racism. The economic inequalities experienced by Black people were seen as foundational to the broader issues of racial discrimination and social injustice. By addressing these economic disparities, the Black Panthers believed they could dismantle the structures of oppression that permeated society.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's what's going on today.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's good. People are kind of going, well, you know, I can't buy a house. Why is that?
Yeah.
or, you know, oh, man, I'm working 60 hours a week. And
why is that?
I can't get by. Why is that?
Yeah.
Well, it's the system that we, you know, there are benefits to capitalism. And this is coming from someone that I've studied. I have a Bachelor of Commerce degree majoring in finance. So I've studied this.
Yeah.
And I've worked in this industry that promotes this crap. But this is what our society is upheld. And a lot of people are drinking that Kool-Aid, man. You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, people have to change their perspective because the system is rigged. You know, there's people don't realize the systematic pressures that exist and all the sort of political agendas that exist too. We're living in this world and we're trying to do our best to be good citizens, you know, paying our taxes and
doing
everything, doing what we need to do to raise our family the best way possible. But if those things aren't there for in certain ways for certain people, they're never going to get ahead. And, you know, just harking back to what you said, why is that?
Yeah.
And that is why. And also with the Black Panthers, you know, they also grew up in an area the 60s were interesting because you had there was a lot of race riots and all over in many different cities, and police brutality took everything was like, you know, a surge of things, especially after the Jim Crow laws were sort of dissipated. But the one thing about Oakland in 1966, there were 651 police officers and only 16 of them were Black, which represented 2.5% of the population of the police department. So I also with that, the Black Panthers got it in their mind. They saw this brutality going on. In fact, what inspired them was a killing of a Black man with an incident with another cop, and that inspired them to sort of create the Black Panther Party. But what they used to do, which you're right, they were leaning towards Malcolm X's kind of theory, by any means necessary, standing, you know, fighting fire with fire, so to speak. But to them, it was actually self-defense because the Black Panther Party was essentially for self-defense of the communities. So anyway, I'm going on rambling. But what I was getting to was the simple fact that they started patrol areas of the community to see what kind of police brutality was happening. And the difference being even between which took them to another level was they started carrying guns. They started arming themselves with weapons. You know, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, they studied the gun laws extensively and were able to purchase some guns, and they started to patrol the area, and they got involved with any sort of chaos that ensued with the cops.
The Black Panthers believe strongly in the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution, which grants the right to bear arms. They argued that if this right was available to all citizens, then it should be exercised by Black Americans as well. This was not only about individual self-protection, but also about asserting their full citizenship and demanding equal rights under the law. Carrying firearms became a symbol of resistance for the Black Panthers. It was a visible declaration that Black people were willing and able to defend themselves against any threats, whether from individuals or institutions. The sight of armed Black men and women patrolling their neighborhoods challenged the notion of Black people as passive or powerless. Their armed activism remains a significant and controversial aspect of their legacy, sparking discussion about gun rights, race relations, and the role of self-defense in marginalized communities.
They had all kinds of good intentions, but, you know, it's also a tricky thing. You're Black. You're already under the radar of the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover, you're on the top of his list.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's how the government started to create the narrative of what they were actually, even though they had good intentions of what they represented, the narrative was different. They started using the mainstream media to sort of disassemble the Black Panthers. And they also started going through to attack some of the people who were doing these programs that they had. They had Serve the People, which was good for the community. Kids were able to eat breakfast before they went to school. They started harassing, the FBI started harassing. There was a group called, what were they called? The COINTELPRO group. They were created by J. Edgar Hoover to start sort of messing with this.
Yeah.
They started harassing people who were in these programs. The government tried to start a turf and gang war with another gang that was prominent, and they just systematically started feeding the narrative that Black Panthers were actually criminals and they were actually, you know, doing drugs and doing all these things, despite all the good that they were doing.
From the time that they came into prominence in 1967, that's when they basically marched into an assembly armed, but mm-hmm. carrying open carry legally.
Mm-hmm.
Into Sacramento, the Sacramento State Legislature is when they came to prominence, national prominence, and they mm-hmm. got the attention of federal agencies, right?
Yeah.
The other thing, like you said, they were after that in, I think it was about 68 or 69, they were deemed a terrorist organization
mm-hmm.
because of this. Mm-hmm. And they were on the radar of both federal, like the FBI in the States, also CSIS.
Let's not get it twisted. The civil rights movement was revolutionary. Revolution usually requires some sort of disruption of the status quo. Of course, there was the nonviolent angle led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but not all the players during that time believed in nonviolence. Malcolm X criticized the nonviolent approach of leaders like King, advocating instead for armed self-defense in the face of violence and oppression. Over time, Malcolm's views evolved and he became more open to collaboration. There was also Robert F. Williams, a civil rights leader and president of the Monroe, North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. He believed that Black Americans should not passively accept violence and discrimination, but should instead defend themselves. He famously wrote the book Negroes with Guns, which argued for armed self-defense against white supremacist violence. And of course, Angela Davis, scholar activist, known for her involvement in the Black Power movement and her work on prison abolition. She argued that violence was a natural response for the violence of racism and oppression. Like these leaders, the Black Panthers believed in armed defense. So there were instances where members of the Black Panther Party were involved in violent confrontations. One of the most well-known incidences was the 1969 shootout between the Panthers and the Los Angeles Police Department at the party's headquarters. On the morning of December 8, 1969, a joint force of around 200 LAPD officers and members of the FBI launched a raid on the Black Panthers' headquarters in Los Angeles. The raid was part of a series of actions taken by law enforcement under the FBI's COUNTIL-PRO program, which sought to disrupt and dismantle Black activist organizations. The raid quickly escalated into a violent exchange of gunfire between the Panthers and the heavily armed police officers. The Panthers, aware of the impending raid, had fortified their headquarters in anticipation of such an attack. They were armed and prepared to defend themselves against what can be described as an unjust and aggressive action by law enforcement. It's important to note that many Panthers were acquitted of any charges related to violence or murder. Legal battles were fought, often highlighting the role of self-defense and the right to bear arms in the face of police aggression. The party maintained that their actions were in response to systemic racism and police brutality.
Yes.
Oh, as well. Right. They were on the radar of CSIS because they, you know, and through that, like you said, both agencies, mm-hmm. both the Canadian agencies and the American agencies, were running counterintelligence on them. And what they would do, from what I was reading, is they would employ Black people from these communities under the guise of being a Black Panther. They would start violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. They would start gang wars. They would. Mm-hmm. They would do this done. They would infiltrate certain aspects of the Black Panthers and do stuff under the guise of being a Black Panther.
Which
kind of ties into what we were talking about their, we've talked about before and we've had guests on before, is the ties of your family,
mm-hmm.
Rocky Jones, and their trips to Canada. The activities of the Black Panthers in Canada during the 1960s played a significant role in connecting the struggles of African Americans in the United States with the experiences of Black Canadians. Here at the Down Home Podcast, we often say that there is more that connects all Black people in North America than sets us apart. The efforts of the Black Panthers in Canada were characterized by attempts to raise awareness about systemic racism, advocate for Black empowerment, and build solidarity among marginalized communities. Just before his tragic assassination by the FBI in 1969, Fred Hampton, a prominent leader of the Chicago Black Panther Party, delivered a powerful speech at the University of Regina. Hampton addressed a range of issues, including the oppression faced by African Americans in the United States. His speech also touched upon the treatment of Indigenous peoples in Canada, drawing parallels between the struggles of different BIPOC communities. Rocky Jones, a key figure in the Canadian Civil Rights Movement, quickly drew the attention of RCMP because of his ties with the Black Panthers. In 1968, Rocky Jones had the opportunity to meet Stokely Carmichael, later known as Kwame Ture, at a writers' conference in Montreal. This meeting led to a close friendship between the two activists. Jones extended an invitation for Ture to visit Halifax, Nova Scotia, marking the beginnings of a deeper connection between the Black Panthers and the Canadian Civil Rights Movement. Following Jones' invitation, a delegation from the Black Panthers visited Halifax, Nova Scotia in November of the same year. This visit was significant as it allowed for the exchange of ideas, strategies, and solidarity. The Panthers sought to highlight the interconnectedness of struggles against racism and oppression on both sides of the border. They brought attention to issues such as police brutality, economic injustice, and the systemic discrimination faced by Black Canadians. In 1968, Rocky Jones played a pivotal role in the establishment of the Black United Front. This grassroots organization emerged from a meeting of 400 representatives of Nova Scotia's Black community, aiming to address issues of racial inequality in the political and economic spheres. The Black United Front became a platform of advocacy, activism, and community organizing.
Yeah, I mean, we had two people mention it. We had guest Patty Jones, who was the son of Rocky Jones, and Walter Borden, who was involved with Rocky Jones back in the day in the 60s when I guess they started the Black United Front.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, Rocky was viewed as a person of interest because of the stuff he was talking about in Halifax. And as you can tell, you know, from not only the Black Panthers, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI had counterintelligence on all the leaders back then, from Malcolm X to Martin Luther King to the Nation of Islam to Elijah Muhammad.
During the 1960s, amid the civil rights movement and the rise of Black power activism, the United States government engaged in extensive surveillance of Black leaders, activists, and organizations. This surveillance, often conducted by agencies such as the FBI, aimed to monitor and disrupt movements for racial equality and social justice. Perhaps one of the most well-known cases of government surveillance was the FBI's targeting of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover, initiated a covert program known as COUNTELPRO, or Counterintelligence Program, to undermine King and the civil rights movement. They wiretapped King's phones, bugged his hotel rooms, and collected extensive files on his personal life in an attempt to discredit him. Other civil rights leaders that were targeted by the program were Malcolm X, Eldridge Cleaver, Fred Hampton, and Stokely Carmichael. According to a Washington Post interview given by Democratic Representative Bobby Rush in May of 2021, there's a potential link between this counterintelligence program run by the FBI and the assassination of Fred Hampton. We want to bring light, a bright light, to a dark history of our nation, and I think it's very timely and very important that we do it at this time, Rush said in the interview. Government activities like COUNTELPRO happened north of the border during the Civil Rights Movement as well. Canada's most well-known civil rights activist, Rocky Jones, was the target. The RCMP employed various surveillance tactics to monitor Rocky Jones's activities. This included wiretapping of phones, surveillance of public meetings and gatherings, and the collection of intelligence on his interactions with other activists. The goal was to gather information on Jones's political affiliations, strategies, and potential plans for his activism. We knew the phone was tapped, and we knew we were under general surveillance, Jones recounted to the Daily News in 1995. Rocky, a lawyer by trade, actually obtained the records that the RCMP kept on him through the Freedom of Information Act. Fred Hampton actually visited the University of Regina and had this impassioned speech about racism in America and the treatment of Indigenous peoples in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
There was some talk before he came up to Regina whether or not the Canadian government was going to allow him to cross the border.
Cross the border. Wow.
Right? And that was 2 weeks before he was actually assassinated in Chicago, I believe.
Yeah. Wasn't that the one where they came up with a raid to just go in and basically and shoot him?
That's the one.
Yeah. They didn't even, they were like, that's where he lives. That's where we're going.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. Yeah. He was actually one of the most sort of, he kind of had that kind of persona of a Malcolm X and Martin Luther King just because of his impassioned speeches. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they certainly didn't like that.
Well, you're right. Like, the reasoning for them coming about, the police brutality and the economic circumstances in the Black community, it's essentially the same reason why Black Lives Matter has come around, right?
And
if you think about it, the structure of Black Lives Matter is made it hard for the powers to be to destabilize them. Now, they did do their best in the media to discredit some of the founders.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
By digging into their economic practices. But you know what? It's a not-for-profit organization. There were economic things, like things were purchased.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
You know, there houses were purchased and stuff like that that were used for BLM operations kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, the way that it was spun in the media was to discredit BLM.
Yeah.
Now, they haven't gone as far as what they've done to the Black Panthers. Now, what they did, the powers that be that did to the Black Panthers, essentially through the 70s and 80s, through assassination of their leaders, discrediting them in the media, branding them as a terrorist organization, the operations kind of ceased to be in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, and that's what's really disheartening is the fact that when you mention sort of how they use media outlets to discredit what they actually were, that's kind of being done today with social media. You know, although social media is a two-headed kind of dragon in the sense of it brings people together in the sense of what's going on in the world, but it also has that, I believe it, and this isn't conspiracy, I believe people just feed into the algorithm and plant seeds of what they want and eventually catches fire. And depending on what the situation is, it can go viral or not. And then you get that sort of mob mentality of what's right and what isn't. And if you can just get people leaning the way you want, you know, it's going to tip over, right? So,
yeah.
And also, the fact that this narrative goes on today, like in every aspect of everybody trying to do right, they've always looked into people's background, like they did it to Martin Luther King, they did it to Malcolm X, and you know, these
Medgar
guys
Evers.
Did it all the time, and also the, you know, the Black organizations.
Yeah,
they did it to all of them. Yeah,
they, in Canada, they did it to Rocky Jones.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and I'm sure even the Black United Front had its issues as well with the powers that be, man.
Yeah.
You know, these organizations are needed. And it's unfortunate that the Black United Front is not around any longer.
Yeah.
What it's been replaced by is there are organizations that are here for the economic betterment of Black people. Like there are business associations that we hope that are doing good work.
Mm-hmm.
And then essentially they have individual organizations. Almost every school has like a BIA, or every university has like some type of Black coalition,
mm-hmm.
which hopefully they're doing good work. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I'm worried about is since the death of George Floyd, there has been each large organization has taken on like this front of having diversity and equity.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what kind of work they're doing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's almost like for show. But yeah. We hope that they're doing good work. You know?
Yeah, no, that's all let's we can hope really do. I mean, the so-called plans are in place. But you never know. Show and tell, right?
Yeah, exactly, man.
Give the people what they want. Yeah. But there's nothing behind the door.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Show them the door. Show them the door. What's behind door number three, Monty? Nothing. But that said is the fact that that's what Black organizations have to do. That's what Black people have to do. That's what people of color have to do. You have to continuously knock on these doors to see what you can find to get yourself in the room. We just want to be part of the conversation, sit at the table, make a difference with our people and you know, the way that it is, because it's not looking good, even though we're completely years removed from Black Panther. We're years removed from the civil rights movement. They did a lot of good, but they were also dismantled. So the only thing we as a people can do is just to keep these conversations alive and keep hoping and just doing better, you know?
Mm-hmm. You have been listening to Down Home. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
On a high plateau, from the one down below to the future of the funk, getting lost in the flow. Contact with the spot, my gex. Now it's time to flex with the force from the soul, reaching all aspects, getting deep, no time to sleep as you reach your next phase, laying it all on the line. New trail start to blaze, it's a fire inside, a brand new path, breaking down the sum to one, feeling free. I just laugh with the joy.
The song Breaking New Ground from The Breakdown. The vibe like magic prescribed, only to seal a perfect blend, like a diamond in the rough, ready to drop a perfect gem. It's time to shine so fine, to see what you find. Revolution.